and you're gone!
How should I know? Mortola shrugged. Let whatever comes here to replace us eat them. Make the fat woman your maid and Darius your boot boy. Anything you like, it's all the same to me. Just start reading!
Orpheus obeyed. He went over to the glass case where the sheet of paper with his words on it was waiting, cleared his throat, and adjusted his glasses.
Capricorn's fortress lay in the forest where the first tracks of giants could be found. The words flowed over his lips like music. It was a long time since anyone had seen the giants, but other and more alarming beings haunted the walls by night. Nightmares and red caps, creatures as cruel as the men who had built the fortress. It was all of gray stone, as gray as the rocky slope behind it.
Do something, thought Eleanor. Do something! It's now or never! Snatch that piece of paper from the moon-faced man's hand! Kick the magpie's stick away!
But she couldn't move a muscle. What a voice! And the magic of the words! They slowed her brain, making her drowsy with delight. When Orpheus read of the prickly woodbine and the tamarisk flowers, Eleanor thought she could smell them.
He really does read as well as Mortimer.
That was the only thought of her own that would form in her head, and the others were no better off. They were all staring at Orpheus's lips as if they could hardly wait for the next word. Darius, Basta, the wardrobe man, even Mortimer. Why, even the magpie. They listened motionless, caught up in the sound of the words. Only one of them moved. Risa. Eleanor saw her struggling against the magic as you might struggle in deep water, finally coming up behind Mortimer and flinging her arms around him. And then they had all disappeared. Basta, Mortola the magpie, and Mortimer, and Risa.
Chapter 18. Mortola's Revenge. It was as if a transparent picture, like stained glass, came down over what Risa had just been seeing. Eleanor's library, the backs of the books so carefully classified by Darius and arranged side by side, blurring it all, while the other picture itself became clearer. Stones eroded the books. Soot-blackened walls replaced the bookshelves. Grass sprouted from Eleanor's wooden floorboards, and the white plaster of the ceiling gave way to a sky covered by dark clouds. Reese's arms were still wound around Mo. He was the only thing that didn't disappear, and she wouldn't let go of him for fear of losing him again after all, as she had lost him once before, so long ago. Risa? She saw the alarm in his eyes as he turned and realized that she had come too. Quickly, she put her hand over his mouth. Honeysuckle climbed up the black walls on their left. Mo put out his hand to the leaves, as if his fingers must feel what his eyes had already seen. Risa remembered that she had once done the same, touching everything, bewildered to find the world beyond the letters on the page so real. If she hadn't heard the words Orpheus had spoken for herself, Risa wouldn't have known where Mortola had made him read them all. Capricorn's fortress had looked so different when she had last stood in its courtyard. There had been men everywhere, armed men on the flights of steps, at the gate, on the wall. Where the bakehouse had stood, there was nothing now but charred beams. And it was by the stairway over there that she and the other maids used to beat the dust from the tapestry hangings. Tapestries that Mortola placed on the walls of the bare rooms only on special occasions. Those rooms were gone. The walls of the fortress were crumbling and black from fire. Soot covered the stones as if someone had painted them with a black brush, and yarrow grew all over the once bare courtyard. Yarrow loved burned earth. It grew everywhere. Where a narrow stairway had once led up to the watchtower, the forest was now making its way into Capricorn's den. Young trees had taken root among the ruins, as if they had just been waiting to reclaim the place occupied by this human abode. Thistles grew in the gaping cavities of the windows, moss covered the ruined stairs, and Ivy climbed to the charred wooden stumps that had once been Capricorn's gallows. Risa had seen many men hanging on them.
"What's this?" Mortola's voice echoed from the dead walls. "What are these miserable ruins? This isn't my son's fortress!"
Risa drew closer to Moe's side. He still seemed numbed, almost as if he were waiting for the moment when he would wake up and see Eleanor's books again instead of the stones. Risa knew only too well how he was feeling. It was not so bad for her the second time. After all, she wasn't alone now, and she knew what had happened. But Moe seemed to have forgotten everything, Mortola, Basta, and why they had brought him here. Risa, however, had not forgotten, and she watched with a thudding heart as Mortola stumbled through the yarrow to the charred walls and felt the stones, as if she were running her fingers over her dead son's face.
"I'll cut that man Orpheus's tongue out with my own hands and serve it for supper," she exclaimed. "With chopped fox lap! Is this supposed to be my son's fortress? Never!"
Her head moved frantically back and forth like a bird's as she looked around her, but Basta just stood there in silence, pointing his gun at Risa and Moe.
"Say something!" shouted the magpie. "Say something, you fool!"
Basta bent down and picked up a rusty helmet lying at his feet. "What do you expect me to say?" he growled, throwing the helmet back into the grass with a gloomy expression, and giving it a kick that sent it clattering against the wall.
"Of course it's our castle. Didn't you see the figure of the goat on the wall there? Even the carved devils are still standing, though they wear ivy crowns now. Oh, and look, there's one of the eyes that Slasher liked to paint on the stones."
Mortola stared at the red eye to which Basta was pointing. Then she hobbled over to the remains of the wooden gate, now splintered, torn off its hinges, and barely visible under the brambles and tall, stinging nettles. She stood there in silence, looking around her. As for Moe, he had finally come back to his senses.
"What are they talking about?" he whispered to Risa. "Where are we? Was this where Capricorn used to hide out?"
Risa just nodded. However, the magpie turned at the sound of Moe's voice and stared at him. Then she came over to him, stumbling as if she felt dizzy.
"Yes, this is his castle, but Capricorn isn't here," she said in a dangerously low voice.
"My son is not here. So, Basta was right after all. He's dead. Here and in the other world, too. Dead? And what killed him?
Your voice! Your accursed voice!"
There was such hatred in her face that Risa instinctively tried to draw Moe away, somewhere, anywhere he would be safe from that glance. But there was nothing behind them but the sooty wall with the figure of Capricorn's goat still displayed on it. A red-eyed goat with burning horns.
"Silver tongue!"
Mortola spat out the word as if it were poison.
"Killer tongue suits you better. Your daughter couldn't bring herself to utter the words that killed my son, but you, oh, you didn't hesitate for a moment."
Her voice was little more than a whisper as she went on.
"I can still see you before me, as if it happened only last night, taking the piece of paper from her hand and putting her aside, and then the words came out of your mouth, fine-sounding as everything you say, and when you'd finished, my son lay dead in the dust."
For a moment she put her fingers to her mouth as if to suppress a sob. When she let her hand drop again, her lips were still quivering.
"How can this be?" she went on in a trembling voice. "Tell me, how is it possible? He didn't belong in your false world at all. How could he die there? Was that the only reason you lured him over with your wicked tongue?"
And again she turned and stared at the burned walls, her bony hands clenched into fists. Basta bent down again. This time he picked up an arrow point.
"I'd really like to know what happened," he muttered.
"Oh, we said Capricorn wasn't here. But what about the others? Firefox, Petita, Humpback, the Piper, Slasher? Are they all dead? Or are they in the Laughing Prince's dungeon?"
He looked uneasily at Mortola.
"What are we going to do if they're all gone?"
Basta sounded like a boy afraid of the dark.
So you want us to live in a cave like brownies until the wolves find us? Have you forgotten the wolves? And the nightmares and the fire elves and all the other creatures crawling round the place? I, for one, haven't forgotten them, but you would come back to this accursed spot where there are ghosts lurking behind every tree!
He reached for the amulet dangling around his neck, but Mortola did not deign to look at him.
Oh, be quiet!
She said so sharply that Basta flinched.
How often must I tell you that ghosts are nothing to be afraid of? As for wolves, that's why you carry a knife, isn't it?
We'll manage. We managed in their world, and we know our way around in this one a good deal better. And don't forget, we have a powerful friend here.
We're going to pay him a visit, yes, that's what.
But first, I have something else to do. Something I should have done long ago.
And again, her eyes were on Mo. On him, and no one else. Then she turned, walked steadily up to Basta, and took the shotgun from his hand. Risa reached for Mo's arm and tried to pull him aside, but Mortola was too quick on the draw. The magpie had some skill with a gun. She'd often shot at the birds who pecked the seed from her garden beds back in Capricorn's yard. Blood spread over Mo's shirt like a flower blossoming. Red, crimson. Risa heard herself scream as he fell, and suddenly lay there motionless, while the grass around him turned as red as his shirt. She flung herself down on her knees, turned him over, and pressed her hands to the wound, as if she could hold back the blood, all the blood carrying his life away.
"Come along, Basta," she heard Mortola say. "We have a long way to go, and it's time we found safe shelter before it gets dark. This forest is not a pleasant place by night."
"You're going to leave them, eh?"
That was Basta's voice.
"Why not? I know you always fancied her, but the wolves will take care of them. The fresh blood will bring them this way."
The blood. It was still flowing so fast, and Mo's face was white as a sheet.
"No! Oh, please, no!"
whispered Risa. Aloud. In her own voice. She pressed her fingers to her shaking lips.
"Well, what do you know? Our little pigeon can speak again."
Basta's mocking voice hardly penetrated the rushing in her ears.
"What a pity he can't hear you any more. Eh? So long, Risa."
She did not look around, not even when their footsteps died away.
"No,"
she heard herself whispering again and again.
"No."
Like a prayer. She tore a strip of fabric from her dress, if only her fingers weren't shaking so badly, and pressed it to the wound. Her hands were wet with his blood and her own tears.
"Risa,"
she told herself sternly. "Crying won't do him any good. Try to remember. What did Capricorn's men do when they were wounded?" They cauterized the wound, but she didn't want to think of that. There had been a plant, too, a plant with hairy leaves and pale mauve flowers, tiny bells into which bumblebees flew buzzing. She looked around through a veil of tears over her eyes as if hoping for a miracle. Two blue-skinned fairies were hovering among the twining honeysuckle. If Dustfinger had been here now, he'd surely have known how to entice them. He'd have called to them softly, persuaded them to give him some of their fairy spit, or the silvery dust that they shook out of their hair. She heard her own sobbing again. She lifted the dark hair back from Mo's brow with her blood-stained fingers, called him by name. He couldn't be gone. Not now. Not after all those years. Over and over she called his name. Put her fingers on his lips, felt his breath, shallow and irregular, coming with difficulty as if someone were sitting on his chest. Death, she thought. It's death. A sound made her jump. Footsteps on soft leaves. Had Mortola changed her mind? Had she sent Basta back to fetch them, or were the wolves coming? If only she had at least had a knife. Mo always carried one. Feverishly, she put her hands in his trouser pockets, feeling for the smooth handle. The footsteps grew louder. Yes, they were human footsteps, no doubt about it. And then suddenly, all was still, menacingly still. Risa felt the handle in her fingers. She quickly removed the knife from Mo's pocket and snapped it open. She hardly dared to turn, but at last she did. An old woman was standing in what had once been Capricorn's gateway. She looked as small as a child among the pillars that still stood erect. She had a sack slung over her shoulder and was wearing a dress that looked as if she had woven it from nettles. Her skin was burned brown, her face furrowed like the bark of a tree. Her gray hair was as short as a marten's fur and had leaves and burrs clinging to it. Without a word, she came toward Risa. Her feet were bare, but she didn't seem to mind the nettles and thistles growing in the courtyard of the ruined fortress. Her face expressionless, she pushed aside Risa and bent over Mo. Unmoved, she lifted the bloody scraps of fabric that Risa was still pressing to the wound.
"I never saw a wound like that before," she remarked, in a voice that sounded hoarse, as if it wasn't often used. "What did it?" "A gun."
The old woman looked at her, shook her head, and bent over Mo again.
"A gun? What may that be?"
she murmured as her brown fingers felt the wound.
"Dear me, these days they go inventing new weapons faster than a chick catches from its egg, and I have to find out how to mend what they stab and cut."
She put her ear to Mo's chest, listened, and straightened up again with a sigh.
"Are you wearing something under that dress?" she asked abruptly without looking at Risa. "Take it off and tear it up. I need long strips."
She put her hand into the leather bag at her belt, took out a little bottle, and used its contents to soak one of the strips of fabric that Risa was offering her. "Press that down on it," she said, handing the fabric back to Risa.
"This is a bad wound. I may have to cauterize it, but not here. The two of us can't carry him on our own, but the strolling players have a camp not far off, for they're old and sick people. I may find help there."
She dressed the wound with fingers as nimble as if she had never done anything else. "Keep him warm," she said as she rose to her feet again and slung the sack over her shoulder. Then she pointed to the knife that Risa had dropped in the grass. "Keep that with you. I'll try to be back before the wolves get here, and if one of the white women turns up, make sure she doesn't look at him or whisper his name." Then she was gone, as suddenly as she had come. And Risa kneeled there in the courtyard of Capricorn's fortress, her hand pressed down on a blood-soaked dressing, and listened to Mo's breathing.
"Can you hear me? My voice is back,"
she whispered to him,
"just as if it had been waiting for you here."
But Mo did not move. His face was as pale as if the stones and grass had drunk all his blood. Risa didn't know how much time had passed when she heard the whispering behind her, incomprehensible and soft as rain. When she looked around, there stood the figure on the ruined stairway, a white woman, blurred as a reflection on water. Risa knew only too well what such an apparition meant. She had told Maggie about the white women often enough. Only one thing lured them, and faster than blood lured the wolves. Failing breath, a heart beating ever more feebly.
"Be quiet!"
Risa shouted at the pale figure bending protectively over Mo's face.
"Go away! And don't you dare look at him! He isn't going with you! Not today!"
"They whisper your name if they want to take you with them," so Dustfinger had told her. "But they don't know Mo's name," thought Risa. "They can't know it because he doesn't belong here." All the same, she held her hands over his ears. The sun was beginning to set. It sank inexorably behind the trees. Darkness fell between the charred walls, and the pale figure on the stairs stood out more clearly all the time. It stood there motionless, waiting. Chapter 19. Birthday Morning. Maggie woke with a start. She had been dreaming, and her dreams had been bad, but she didn't remember what they were about. Only the fear they left behind, like a knife wound in the heart. Noise came to her ears, shouting and loud laughter, children's voices, the barking of dogs, the grunting of pigs, hammering, sawing. She felt sunlight on her face, and the air she was breathing smelled of dung and freshly baked bread. Where was she? Only when she saw Finolio sitting at his desk did she remember. Ombra. She was in Ombra.
"Good morning,"
Fenelio had obviously slept extremely well. He looked very pleased with himself and the world in general. Well, who should be pleased with it if not the man who made it up? The glass man Maggie had seen last night asleep beside the jug of quill pens was standing beside him.
"Say hello to our guest, Rosenquartz," Fenelio told him.
The glass man bowed stiffly in Maggie's direction, took Fenelio's dripping pen, wiped it on a rag, and put it back into the jug with the others. Then he bent to look at what Fenelio had written.
"Ah, not a song about this blue jay for a change," he snapped. "Are you taking this one up to the castle today?"
"I am indeed," said Fenelio loftily. "Now, do please make sure the ink doesn't run." The glass man wrinkled his nose as if he had never allowed such a thing to happen, put both hands into the bowl of sand standing next to the pens, and scattered the fine grains over the freshly written parchment with practiced energy.
"Rosenquartz, how often do I have to tell you?" snapped Fenelio. "Too much sand, too much energy, that way you smudge everything."
The glass man brushed a couple of grains of sand off his hands and folded his arms, looking injured.
"Then you do better. I'd certainly like to see that,"
he added sharply, examining Fenelio's clumsy fingers with such scorn that Maggie had to laugh. "Me too," she said, pulling her dress on over her head. A few withered flowers from the wayless wood still clung to it, and Maggie couldn't help thinking of Farid. Had he found Dustfinger?
"Hear that?"
Rosenquartz cast her a friendly glance.
"She sounds like a clever girl."
"Oh, yes, Maggie's very clever," replied Fenelio. "The two of us have been through a lot together. It's thanks to her that I'm sitting here now, trying to tell a glass man the right way to scatter sand over ink."
Rosenquartz looked curiously at Maggie, but he didn't ask what Fenelio's mysterious comment meant. Maggie went up to the desk and looked over the old man's shoulder. "Your handwriting's easier to read these days," she said.
"Thank you very much," murmured Fenelio. "You should know. But look, do you see that smudged P?"
"If you are seriously suggesting that I'm to blame for it,"
said Rosenquartz in his little voice,
"then this is the last time I hold a pen for you. I'm going straight up to look for a scribe. You won't expect me to work before breakfast. Tell us about that."
All right. I'm not blaming you. I smudged the P myself."
Fenelio winked at Maggie.
"He's easily offended,"
he whispered confidentially to her.
"His pride is as fragile as his limbs."
The glass man turned his back on Fenelio without a word, picked up the rag he had used to clean the pen, and tried to wipe the still damp ink spot off his arm. His limbs were not entirely colorless, like those of the glass people who had lived in Eleanor's garden. Everything about him was pale pink, like the flowers of a wild rose. Only his hair was slightly darker.
"You didn't say anything about my new song," Fenelio pointed out. "Wonderful. Don't you agree?"
"It's not bad,"
replied Rosenquartz without turning around and began polishing up his feet.
"Not bad? It's a masterpiece, you maggot-colored ink-smudging pen holder!"
Fenelio struck the desk so hard that the glass man fell over on his back like a beetle.
"I'm on the market today to get a new glass man, one who knows about these things, and will appreciate my robber socks, too."
He opened a longish box and took out a stick of sealing wax.
"At least you haven't forgotten to get a flame for the wax this time," he growled.
Rosenquartz snatched the sealing wax from his hand and held it in the flame of the candle that stood beside the jug. His face expressionless, he placed the melting end of the wax on the parchment roll, waved his glass hand over the red seal a couple of times, and then cast Fenelio an imperious glance, whereupon Fenelio solemnly pressed the ring he wore on his middle finger down onto the soft wax.
F for Fenelio, F for fantasy, F for fabulous, he announced. "Here we are." "B for breakfast would sound better on us now," said Rosenquartz.
But Fenelio ignored this remark.
"What did you think of the song for the prince?"
he asked Maggie. I couldn't read it all because you two were quarreling," she said evasively. She didn't want to make Fenelio even gloomier by saying that the line struck her as familiar. "Why does the laughing prince want such a sad poem?" she asked instead.
"Because his son is dead," replied Fenelio.
"One sad song after another, that's all he wants to hear since Cosimo's death. I'm tired of it."
Sighing, he put the parchment back on his desk and went over to the chest standing under the window.
"Cosimo? Cosimo the Fair is dead?"
Maggie couldn't conceal her disappointment. Risa had told her so much about the Laughing Prince's son. Everyone who saw him loved him. Even the Adderhead feared him. His peasants brought their sick children to him because they believed anyone as beautiful as an angel could cure all sickness, too. Fenolio sighed. Yes, it's terrible. And a bitter lesson. This story isn't my story anymore. It's developed a will of its own.
Oh, no, here we go again, Rosenquartz groaned. His story, I never understand all this talk. Maybe you really ought to go out and see one of those physicians who cure the sick minds, huh?
My dear Rosenquartz, Fenolio replied, all this talk, as you call it, is above your transparent little head. But believe me, Maggie knows just what I'm talking about. He opened the chest looking cross and took out a long, dark blue robe.
I ought to get a new one made, he muttered. Yes, I definitely ought to. This is no robe for a man whose words are sung up and down the land. A man commissioned by a prince to put his grief for his son into words. Just look at the sleeves, hulls, everywhere. In spite of Minerva's sprigs of lavender, the moths have been at it.
It's good enough for a poor poet,
remarked the glass man in matter-of-fact tones. Fenolio put the robe back in the chest and let the lid fall into place with a dull thud.
One of these days, he said, I am going to throw something really hard at you.
This threat did not seem to bother Rosenquartz unduly. The two went on wrangling about this and that. It seemed to be kind of a game they played, and had obviously forgotten Maggie's presence entirely. She went to the window, pushed aside the fabric over it, and looked out. It was going to be a sunny day, although mist still lingered above the hills surrounding the city. Which was the hill where the house of the minstrel woman stood, the place where Farid hoped to find Dustfinger? She had forgotten. Would he come back if he actually found the Fire Eater? Or would he just go off with him like last time, forgetting that she was there, too? Maggie didn't even try to work out just how the idea made her feel. There was enough turmoil in her heart already, so much turmoil that she'd have liked to ask Fenolio for a mirror, just to see herself for a moment. Her own familiar face amid all the strangeness surrounding her, all the strange feelings in her heart. But instead she let her gaze wander over the misty hills. How far did Fenolio's world go? Just as far as he had described it?
Interesting, he had whispered back when Basta had dragged the two of them off to Capricorn's village.
Do you know, this place is very like one of the settings I thought of for Inkheart.
It must have been Umbra, he meant. The hills around Umbra really did look like those over which Maggie had escaped with Mo and Eleanor when Dustfinger set them free from Capricorn's dungeons. Except that these seemed even greener, if that was possible, and more enchanted, as if every leaf suggested that fairies and fire elves lived under the trees, and the houses and streets you could see from Fenolio's room might have been in Capricorn's village, if they hadn't been so much noisier and more colorful.
Just look at the crowds. They all want to go up to the castle today, said Fenolio behind her. Traveling peddlers, peasants, craftsmen, rich merchants, beggars, they're all going to be there to celebrate the birthday, to earn or spend a few coins, to enjoy themselves. Most of all, to stare at the grand folk.
Maggie looked at the castle walls. They rose above the russet rooftops almost menacingly. Black banners on the towers flapped in the wind. How long has Cosimo been dead?
Hardly a year yet. I just moved into this room. As you can imagine, your voice took me straight to where it plucked the shadow out of the story, the middle of Capricorn's fortress. Fortunately, all was hopeless confusion there because the monstrous shadow had disappeared, and none of the fire raisers noticed an old man suddenly standing among them looking foolish. I spent a couple of dreadful days in the forest, and unfortunately, I didn't, like you, have a clever companion who could use a knife, catch rabbits, and kindle fire with a couple of dry twigs. But the Black Prince himself finally picked me up. Imagine how I stared when he was suddenly there in front of me. I didn't think I knew any of the men who were with him, but I'll admit that I could never remember the minor characters in my stories very clearly, only vaguely, if at all. Well, be that as it may, one of them took me to Umbra, ragged and destitute as I was. But luckily, I had a ring that I could sell. A goldsmith gave me enough for it to allow me to rent this room from Minerva, and all seemed to be going well. Very well, indeed. In fact, I thought of stories and stories about stories better than any I'd made up for a long time. The words came pouring out of me. But when I only just made my name with the first songs I wrote for the Laughing Prince, when the strolling players had just begun to find that they liked my verses, Firefox goes and burns down a few farms by the river. Cosmo the Ferret gets out to put an end to Firefox and his gang once and for all. Good, I thought, why not? How was I to guess that he'd get himself killed? I had such plans for him. Ugh. He was to be a truly great prince. A blessing to his subjects, and my story was going to give them a happy ending when he freed this world from the Adderhead. But instead he gets himself killed by a band of fire raisers in the Wayless Wood. Finolio sighed. At first his father wouldn't believe he was dead, for Cosimo's face was badly burned, like those of all the other dead who were brought back. The fire had done its work, but when months passed, and he still didn't return. Finolio sighed again, and once more looked into the chest where the moth-eaten robe lay. He handed Maggie two long, pale blue woolen stockings, a couple of leather straps, and a much-washed dark blue dress. I'm afraid this'll be too big for you. It belongs to Minerva's second daughter, and she's the same size as her mother, he said. But what you're wearing now urgently needs a wash. You can keep the stockings on with those garters. Not very comfortable, but yeah, you'll get used to it. Good Lord, you really have grown, Maggie, he said, turning his back to her as she changed her clothes.
Hey, Rosenquist, turn around too.
It was true that the dress didn't fit particularly well, and Maggie suddenly felt almost glad that Finolio had no mirror. At home, she'd been studying her reflection quite often recently. It was odd to watch your own body changing, as if you were a butterfly coming out of its chrysalis.
Ready? Said Finolio, turning around.
Well, that'll do. Although such a pretty girl really deserves a prettier dress. He looked down at himself and sighed.
Yeah, well, I think I better stay as I am. At least this robe doesn't have any holes in it. What does it matter? The castle will be swarming with entertainers and fine folk today, and no one will take any notice of the two of us.
Do? What do you mean?
Rosenquartz put down the blade he had been using to sharpen a pen.
Aren't you going to take me with you?
What, are you crazy?
Just for me to carry you back in pieces?
No. Anyway, you'd have to listen to that bad poem I'm taking to the prince.
Rosenquartz was still grumbling as Finolio closed the door behind him. The wooden staircase that Maggie had hardly been able to climb last night, exhausted as she was, led down to a yard surrounded by houses with pigsties, woodsheds, and vegetable plots competing for what little space was left. A narrow little stream wound its way through the yard. Two children were shooing away a pig from the vegetable beds, and a woman with a baby in her arms was feeding a flock of skinny hens.
"Wonderful morning, isn't it, Minerva?"
Finolio called to her as Maggie hesitantly followed him down the last steep steps. Minerva came to the foot of the stairs. A girl of perhaps six was clinging to her skirt and stared suspiciously at Maggie. She stopped, feeling unsure of herself. Perhaps they can see it, she thought. Perhaps they can see I don't belong here.
Watch out!
The little girl called, but before Maggie realized what she meant, something was pulling her hair. The little girl threw a clod of earth, and the fairy fluttered away empty-handed, scolding crosses.
Good heavens, where are you from?
Asked Minerva, helping Maggie down from the steps.
Aren't there any fairies there? They're crazy for human hair, particularly when it's as pretty as yours. If you don't pin it up, you'll soon be bald. And anyway, you're too old to wear it loose. Not unless you want to be taken for one of the strolling players.
Minerva was small and stocky, not much taller than Maggie.
My word, how thin you are, she said. That dress is almost slipping off your shoulders. I'll take it in for you this evening. Has she had any breakfast?
She asked and shook her head at the sight of Finolio's baffled expression.
Dear Lord, surely you didn't forget to give the girl something to eat.
Finolio helplessly raised his hands.
I'm an old man, Minerva, he cried. I do forget things. What's the matter with everyone this morning? I was in such a good mood, but y'all keep going on at me like this. Rosenquartz has already been infuriating me.
By way of answer, Minerva dumped the baby in his arms and led Maggie off with her.
Whose baby is this?
inquired Finolio, following her. "Aren't there enough children running around this place already?"
"It's my eldest daughter's," was all Minerva replied, "and you've seen it a couple of times before. Are you getting so forgetful that I'll have to reintroduce my own children to you?"
Minerva's younger children were called Despina and Evo. Evo was the boy who had been carrying Finolio's torch last night. He smiled at Maggie as she and his mother came into the kitchen. Minerva made Maggie eat a plate of polenta and two slices of bread spread with a paste that smelled of olives. The milk she gave her was so rich that Maggie's tongue felt coated with cream after the first sip. As she ate, Minerva pinned up her hair for her. Maggie scarcely recognized herself when Minerva pushed a bowl of water over to her so that she could see her reflection.
"Wow, where did you get those boots?"
asked Evo. His sister was still inspecting Maggie like some strange animal that had lost its way and wandered into their kitchen. Where indeed? Maggie hastily tried to pull down the dress to hide her boots, but it was too short.
"Maggie comes from far away," explained Finolio, who had noticed her confusion. "Very far away. A place where there are people there with three legs, and other whose noses grow on the chins."
The children stared first at him, and then at Maggie.
"Oh, stop it. What nonsense you do talk."
Minerva lightly cuffed the back of his head.
"They believe every word you say. One of these days they'll be setting off to look for all the crazy places you tell them about, and I'll be left childless."
Maggie almost choked on the rich milk. She had quite forgotten her homesickness. But Minerva's words brought it back. And her guilty conscience, too. She'd been away from home 5 days now. If she'd been keeping count correctly.
"Oh, you and your stories," Minerva handed Finolio a mug of milk.
"As if it wasn't enough for you to keep telling them those robber tales. Do you know what Evo said to me yesterday? When I'm grown up, I'm going to join the robbers, too. He wants to be like the Blue Jay. What do you think you're doing, pray tell? Tell them about Cosimo, for all I care. Tell them about the giants or the Black Prince and his bear, but not another word about that Blue Jay. Understand?"
"Yes, not another word," muttered Finolio. "But don't blame me if the boy picks up one of the songs about him from somewhere. Everyone's singing him."
Maggie had no idea what they were talking about, but in her mind, she was already up at the castle anyway. Risa had told her that the birds' nests clustered together on its walls so thickly that sometimes the twittering drowned out the minstrels' songs. And fairies nested there, too, she said. Fairies who were pale gray like the stone of the castle walls because they often nibbled human food instead of living on flowers and fruits like their sisters in the wild. And there were said to be trees in the inner courtyard of the castle that grew nowhere else except in the very heart of the Wayless Wood. Trees with leaves that murmured in the wind like a chorus of human voices and foretold the future on moonless nights, but in a language that no one could understand.
"Would you like anything else to eat?"
Maggie started to come down to earth
again. Inky
Infernos! Finolio rose and handed the baby back to Minerva.
"Do you want to fatten her up until she fits into that dress? We must be off. We'll miss half of it. The prince has asked me to bring him the new song before midday, and you know he doesn't like people to be late."
"No, I don't know any such thing," replied Minerva grumpily as Finolio propelled Maggie toward the door.
"Because I don't go in and out of the castle the way you do. What does our fine prince want from you this time? Another lament?"
"Yes, I've had enough of them too, but he pays well. Would you rather I was penniless and you had to look for a new lodger?"
Very well," grumbled Minerva, clearing the children's empty bowls off the table.
"I tell you what, though. This prince of ours will sigh and lament himself to death, and then the Adderhead will send his men-at-arms. They'll settle here like flies on fresh horse dung, on the excuse of just wanting to protect their master's poor fatherless grandson."
Finolio turned so abruptly that he almost sent Maggie flying.
"No, Minerva, no," he said firmly. "That won't happen. Not as long as I live, which I hope will be for a very long time yet."
"Oh, yes?"
Minerva removed her son's fingers from the tub of butter. "And how are you going to prevent it, with your robber songs? Do you think some fool with a feathered mask playing the hero because he's listened to your songs too often can keep the men-at-arms away from our city?"
Heroes end up in the gallows, Fenoglio, she continued, lowering her voice, and Maggie could hear the fear behind her mockery. It may be different than your songs, but in real life, princes hang them, and the finest of words don't change that.
The two children looked uneasily at their mother, and Minerva stroked their hair as if that would wipe away her own words. But Fenoglio merely shrugged.
Oh, come on, you see everything in such dismal hues, he said. You underestimate the power of words. Believe me, they are strong, stronger than you think. Ask Maggie.
But before Minerva could do just that, he was pushing Maggie out of the house.
Evo, Despina, do you want to come?
He called to the children.
I'll bring them home safe and sound. I always do,
he added as Minerva's anxious face appeared in the doorway.
The best entertainers far and wide will be at the castle today. They'll have come from very far away. You two can't miss this chance.
As soon as they stepped out of the alley, they were caught up in the crowd streaming along. People came thronging up from all sides, shabbily dressed peasants, beggars, women with children, and men whose wealth showed not only in the magnificence of their embroidered sleeves, but most of all by the servants who roughly forced a path through the crowd for them. Riders drove their horses through the throng without a thought for those they pushed against the walls. Litters were jammed in the crush of bodies, however angrily the litter bearers cursed and shouted.
Devil take it! This is worse than market day!
Fenoglio shouted to Maggie above the heads around them. Evo darted through the crowd, quick as a herring in the sea, but Despina looked so alarmed that Fenoglio finally put her up on his shoulders before she was squashed between baskets and people's bellies. Maggie felt her own heart beat faster, what with all the confusion, the pushing and shoving, the thousands of smells and the voices filling the air.
Look around you, Maggie! Isn't it wonderful?
Cried Fenoglio proudly. It was indeed. It was just as Maggie had imagined it on all those evenings when Risa had told her about the Ink World. Her senses were quite dazed. Eyes, ears, they could scarcely take in a tenth of what was going on around her. Music came from somewhere, trumpets, jingles, drums, and then the street widened, spewing her and all the others out in front of the castle walls. They towered among the other buildings, tall and massive, as if they had been built by larger men than those now flocking to the gateway. Armed guards stood in front of the gate with their helmets reflecting the pale morning light. Their cloaks were dark green, like the tunics they wore over their coats of mail. Both bore the emblem of the Laughing Prince. Risa had described it to Maggie, a lion on a green background, surrounded by white roses. But it had changed. The lion wept silver tears now, and the roses twined around a broken heart. The guards let most of the crowd pass, only occasionally barring someone's way with the shaft of a spear or a mailed fist. No one seemed troubled by that. They went on pressing in, and Maggie, too, finally found herself in the shadow of those meter-thick walls. Of course she'd seen castles before, with Mo, but it felt quite different to be going in past guards armed with spears instead of a kiosk selling picture postcards. The walls seemed so much more threatening and forbidding. Look, they seemed to say, see how small you are, how powerless and fragile. Fenoglio appeared to feel none of this. He was beaming like a child at Christmas. He ignored both the portcullis above their heads and the slits through which hot pitch would be tipped out on the heads of uninvited guests. Maggie, on the contrary, instinctively looked up as they passed and wondered why the traces of pitch on the weathered stone looked so fresh. But finally, the open sky was above her again, clear and blue, as if it had been swept clean for the princely birthday. And Maggie was in the outer courtyard of Umbra Castle. Chapter 20 Visitors from the Wrong Side of the Forest. First of all, Maggie looked for the birds' nests that Risa had described, and sure enough, there they were, clinging just below the battlements like blisters on the walls. Birds with yellow breasts shot out of the entrance holes, like flakes of gold dancing in the sun, Risa had said. And she was right. The sky above Maggie seemed to be covered with swirling gold, all in honor of the princely birthday. More and more people surged through the gateway, although there was already a milling crowd in the courtyard. Stalls had been set up within the walls, in front of the stables and the huts where the blacksmiths worked, grooms, and everyone else employed in the castle lived and worked. Today, as the prince was inviting his subjects to celebrate with him the birthday of his grandson and royal heir, food and drink was free.
"Very generous, I'm sure,"
Mo would probably have whispered. Food and drink from their own fields, won by the labor of their own hands. Mo did not particularly like castles. But that was the way of Finolio's world. The land on which the peasants toiled belonged to the Laughing Prince, who was now the Prince of Sighs. So a large part of the harvest was his, too. And he dressed in silk and velvet, while his peasants wore much-mended smocks that scratched the skin. Despina had wound her thin arms around Finolio's neck when they passed the guards at the gate. But at the sight of the first entertainer, she quickly slipped off his back. One of them had stretched his rope between the battlements, and was walking high up in the air, moving more lightly than a spider on its silver thread. His clothes were blue as the sky above him, for blue was the color of the tightrope walkers. Maggie's mother had told her that, too. If only Risa had been here. The motley folk were everywhere among the stalls. Pipers and jugglers, knife throwers, strongmen, animal tamers, contortionists, actors, clowns. Right in front of the wall, Meggie saw a fire eater. Yes, black and red was their costume, and for a moment she thought it was Dustfinger, but when the man turned, he was a stranger with an unscarred face, and the smile with which he bowed to the people around him was not at all like Dustfinger's. But he must be here if he's really back, thought Maggie as she looked around for him. Why did she feel so disappointed? As if she didn't know. It was Fareed she really missed. And if Dustfinger wasn't here, she supposed it would be no use looking for Fareed either.
Come along, Maggie!
Despina pronounced her name as if it was going to take her tongue some time to get used to it. She pulled Maggie over to a stall selling sweet cakes dripping with honey. Even today, those cakes had to be paid for. The trader selling them was keeping a close eye on his wares, but luckily Finolio had a few coins on him. Despina's thin fingers were sticky when she put them into Maggie's hand again. She looked around, wide-eyed, and kept stopping, but Finolio impatiently waved them on past a wooden platform decked with flowers and evergreen branches rising above the stalls. The black banners flying from the castle battlements and towers overhead hung here as well, to the right and left of three thrones on the platform. The backs of the seats were embroidered with the emblem of the Weeping Lion. Why three thrones, I ask myself? Finolio whispered to Maggie as he urged her and the children on. The Prince of Sighs himself won't be showing his face anyway. Come along, we're late already. With a firm step, he turned his back on the busy scene in the outer courtyard and made his way to the inner ring of the castle walls. The gate toward which he was moving was not quite as tall as the one in the outer ring, but it too looked forbidding, and so did the guards who crossed their spears as Finolio approached them.
"As if they don't know me," he whispered crossly to Maggie. "But we have to play the same game every time.
Tell the prince that Finolio the poet is here,"
he said, raising his voice as the two children pressed close to him and stared at the spears as if looking for dried blood on their points.
"Is the prince expecting you?"
The guard who spoke seemed to still be very young, judging by what could be seen of his face under his helmet.
"Of course he is,"
snapped Finolio.
"And if he has to wait any longer, I'll blame it on you, Anselmo. What's more, if you want me to write you a few fine-sounding words as you did last month..."
Here the guard cast a nervous glance at his fellow sentry, but the latter pretended not to have heard and looked up at the tightrope walker.
"Then,"
Finolio concluded, lowering his voice,
"I shall keep you waiting in your own turn. I'm an old man, and God knows I have better things to do than to kick my heels here in front of your spear."
All that could be seen of Anselmo's face turned as red as the sour wine that Finolio had drunk beside the strolling player's fire. However, he did not move his spear aside. "The fact is, Inkweaver, we have visitors," he said in an undertone.
"Visitors? What are you talking about?"
But Anselmo wasn't looking at Finolio anymore. The gate behind him opened, creaking as if its own weight were too heavy for it. Maggie drew Despina aside. Finolio took Ivo's hand. Soldiers rode into the outer courtyard, armed horsemen, their cloaks silvery gray, like the greaves they wore on their legs, and the emblem on their breasts was not the Laughing Prince's.
It showed a viper's slender body rearing up in search of prey, and Maggie recognized it at once. This was the Adderhead's coat of arms. Nothing moved in the outer courtyard now. All was silent as the grave. The entertainers, even the blue-clad tightrope walker high above on his rope, were all forgotten. Risa had told Maggie exactly what the Adderhead's emblem looked like. She had seen it often enough at close quarters. Envoys from the Castle of Night had been welcome guests in Capricorn's fortress. Many of the farms set on fire by Capricorn's men, so rumor said at the time, had been burned down on the Adderhead's orders. Maggie held Despina close as the men-at-arms rode by them. Their breastplates glinted in the sun. It looked as if not even a bolt from a crossbow could pierce that armor, let alone a poor man's arrow. Two men rode at their head. One was a redhead, in armor like the soldiers following him, but resplendent in a cloak of foxtails, while the other was wearing a green robe shot with silver that was fine enough for any prince. However, what everyone noticed about him first was not that robe, but his nose. Unlike ordinary noses of flesh and blood, it was made of silver.
"Look at that couple. What a team," Fenolia whispered to Maggie as the two men rode side by side through the silent crowd. "Both of them my creations, and both once Capricorn's men. Your mother may have told you about them. Firefox was Capricorn's deputy, the Piper was his minstrel. But the silver nose? Wasn't my idea. Nor the fact that they escaped Cosimo's soldiers when they attacked Capricorn's fortress, and now serve the Adderhead."
But it was still eerily silent in the courtyard. There was no sound but the clatter of hooves, the snorting of horses, the clank of armor, weapons, and spears, curiously loud, as if the sounds were caught between the high walls like birds. The Adderhead himself was one of the last to ride in. There was no mistaking him.
"He looks like a butcher," Risa had said. "A butcher in princely clothes, with his love of killing written all over his coarse face."
The horse he rode was white, heavily built like its master, and almost entirely hidden by a caparison patterned with the snake emblem. The Adderhead himself wore a black robe embroidered with silver flowers. His skin was tanned by the sun, his sparse hair was gray, his mouth curiously small, a lipless slit in his coarse, clean-shaven face. Everything about him seemed heavy and fleshy, his arms and legs, his thick neck, his broad nose. Unlike those richer subjects of the Laughing Prince who were now standing in the courtyard, he wore no jewelry, no heavy chains around his neck, no rings set with precious stones on his fat fingers. But gems sparkled in the corners of his nostrils, red as drops of blood. And on the middle finger of his left hand, over his glove, he wore the silver ring he used for sealing death warrants. His eyes, narrow under lids folded like a salamander's, darted restlessly around the courtyard. They seemed to linger for a split second, like a lizard's sticky tongue on everything they saw. The strolling players, the tightrope walker overhead, the rich merchants waiting beside the empty, flower-decked platform, submissively bowing their heads when his glance rested on them. Nothing seemed to escape those salamander eyes, nothing at all. No child pressing his face into his mother's apron in alarm, no beautiful woman, no man glaring up at him with hostility. Yet he reined in his horse in front of only one person in the crowd.
"Well, well. So, here's the king of the strolling players. Last time I saw you, your head was in the pillory of my castle courtyard. And when are you going to honor us with another visit?"
The Adderhead's voice rang out through the silent courtyard. It sounded very deep, as if it came from the black interior of his stout body. Maggie instinctively moved closer to Finolio's side. But the Black Prince bowed so deeply that the bow turned to mockery.
"I'm sorry," he said loud enough for everyone to hear, "but I'm afraid my bear didn't care for your hospitality. He says the pillory was rather tight for his neck."
Maggie saw the adder head's mouth twist into an unpleasant smile.
Well, I could keep a rope ready for your next visit. A rope that will fit perfectly, and a gallows of oak strong enough for even such a fat old bear as yours, he said.
The Black Prince turned to his bear and pretended to discuss it with him.
Soar again,
he said as the bear threw its paws around his neck, grunting.
The bear says he likes the south, but your shadow lies too dark over it. He won't come until the Blue Jay pays you the honor of a visit, too.
A soft whisper ran through the crowd, and was silenced when the Adderhead turned in his saddle and let his lizard-like gaze move over those standing around him.
And furthermore,
the prince continued in a loud voice,
the bear would like to know why you don't make the pipe a trot behind your horse on a silver chain, as such a good tame minstrel should.
The piper wrenched his horse around, but before he could urge it toward the Black Prince, the adder raised a hand.
I will let you know just as soon as the Blue Jay is my guest, he said,
while the silver-nosed man reluctantly rode back to his place.
And believe me, that will be before long. I've already ordered the gallows to be built.
Then he spurred his horse, and the men-at-arms rode on again. It seemed an eternity before the last of them disappeared through the gateway.
Yeah, off you ride,
whispered Finolio as the castle courtyard gradually filled with carefree noise again. Viewing this place as if it would all soon be his, thinking he can spread his power through my world like a running sore and play a part I never wrote for him. Psst. The guard's spear abruptly silenced him.
Very well, poet, said Anselmo. You can go in now. Off with you.
Off with you,
thundered Finolio.
Is that the way to speak to the prince's poet?
Listen, he told the two children. You better stay here. Don't eat too much cake, and don't go too close to the fire either, because he's useless at his job, and leave the Black Prince's bear alone. Understand?
The two of them nodded and ran straight to the nearest cake stall. But Finolio took Maggie's hand and strode past the guards with her, his head held high.
Finolio, she asked in a low voice as the gate closed behind them and the noise of the outer courtyard died away. Who is the Blue Jay?
It was cool behind the great gate, as if winter had built itself a nest here. Trees shaded a wide courtyard. The air was fragrant with the scent of roses and other flowers whose names Maggie didn't know, and a stone basin of water, round as the moon, reflected the part of the castle in which the Laughing Prince lived.
Oh, he doesn't exist,
was all Finolio would say as he impatiently beckoned her on. But I'll explain all that later. Come along now. We must take the Laughing Prince my verses at last, or I won't be his court poet anymore.
Chapter 21 The Prince of Sighs. The windows of the hall where the Prince of Sighs, once the Laughing Prince, received Finolio were hung with black draperies. The place smelled like a crypt, of dried flowers and soot from the candles. The candles were burning in front of statues which had all the same face, sometimes a good likeness, sometimes less good.
Cosimo the Fair, thought Maggie.
He stared down at her from countless pairs of marble eyes as she walked toward his father with Finolio. The throne in which the Prince of Sighs sat enthroned stood between two other high-backed chairs. The dark green upholstery of the chair on his left was occupied only by a helmet with a plume of peacock feathers, its metal brightly polished as if it were waiting for its owner. A boy of about 5 or 6 sat in the chair on his right. He wore a black brocade doublet embroidered all over with pearls as if it were covered in tears. This must be the birthday boy. Jacopo, grandson of the Prince of Sighs. But the Adderhead's grandson, too. The child looked bored. He was swinging his short legs restlessly as if he could hardly prevent himself from running outside to the entertainers and the sweet cakes and the armchair waiting for him on the platform adorned with prickly bindweed and roses. His grandfather, on the other hand, looked as if he never intended to rise from his chair again.
He sat there as powerless as a puppet, in black robes that were too large for him now, as if hypnotized by the eyes of his dead son. Not particularly tall, but fat enough for two men, that was how Risa had described him, seldom seen without anything to eat in his greasy fingers, always rather breathless because of the weight his legs, which were not especially strong, had to carry, and